is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, welcome back. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Shane and I have been talking about this ACA. It feels like we've been doing the radio show. The Supreme Court just ruled on the Affordable Care Act. And Shano, you want to explain what happened? You're the law school graduate here and a certified Supreme Court reporter, actually, with credentials and everything.
Yeah. Well, it was a big win, of course. I mean, everyone's probably heard this right now. So what the Supreme Court did was say, we're going to look at the entire text of the ACA. You know, what happened in this case, of course, is everyone already knows, but we'll recap real quickly, is opponents of the ACA went in and said, hang on, my levels are a little low here, sorry, went in and said, this one specific phrase of the Affordable Care Act says that subsidies to buy health insurance may only go through exchanges established by the state. Mm-hmm. And there's one little section of IRS Code 36B. The Supreme Court said, we're not going to just look at this one sentence. They said, we're going to look at the entire ACA, the entire Affordable Care Act, and we're going to interpret that sentence in light of the other sections of the ACA. And they determined that regardless of whether that said exchanges established by the state, we're just going to apply this to state and federal exchanges because it doesn't make any sense otherwise.
Right.
Things that they did is they went and extrapolated out, if you were to only allow these subsidies through the state exchanges, how it would affect other parts of the ACA, how it would essentially fall apart on itself, and how it affects states that didn't, that allowed the federal government to set up these exchanges, how there would be a death spiral in terms of all people would not go get insurance because there were three parts to the Affordable Care Act. Everyone gets insurance, no pre-existing conditions, and we're going to make it affordable by doing these subsidies. If you get rid of any one of those three, through history, as states have tried it that way,
it blows up.
You have a death spiral. So, and they said Congress could not have possibly meant to enact a law that's going to create a death spiral in terms of health coverage. So therefore, you know, and there was another section of it where they also said the states shall establish an exchange. That was part one. Part two, if they don't, the Secretary of Health shall establish, and it said, such exchange. And this was really key to them because the use of the word, of the phrase, I should say, such exchange in their minds, and the justices that voted for this, the six, such exchange meant that the two exchanges were the equivalents.
Right.
They operated the same way. They had the same parameters. They had the same requirements, the same ways to get into it. They were going to operate similarly from state to state, so they were the same thing.
Right. Now, my take on it, you know, I originally had, in fact, last night on television, I predicted that I thought that it was going to come down pretty much like exactly like it did. I didn't know where Kennedy was going to go, but I knew that Roberts was going to be in favor of maintaining it. Mm-hmm. Why? Because Roberts always votes for the big corporations.
Right.
Always, always, always. And what happened as soon as this decision came down? The stock value of all of the insurance companies just jumped up.
Did it really?
Oh, absolutely. and the same thing with the big hospital chains, both of them. They just went up. And, you know, for predictable reasons. I mean, this is, you know, 8 million more customers. It's, you know, the ACA is a boon to big corporations as well as to the American people. And, you know, it's we could get the same thing for half the price if we did Bernie Sanders Medicaid for all, or Medicare for all, rather. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if we're going to do it this way, it's you know, it seems to be the American way. Make sure that somebody gets rich and things get done.
Interestingly, the dissent was written by Justice Scalia.
Right. And what's interesting is in both the decision and the dissent, they mm-hmm. cited
Marbury versus Madison,
yeah. saying we have the power to decide this. And then.
Right.
And then
Scalia said, "We have the power to tell you what the law is, but we don't have the power to rewrite the law."
Right.
But
right.
he has some great quotes because his dissent, was pretty sarcastic,
right.
as he is often wont to do. Some of the lines, "We should start calling this law SCOTUS care." look for the right to start bringing that up.
Right.
Another quote: "Words no longer have meaning. Mm. Today's interpretation is not merely unnatural; it's unheard of." And the cases will publish forever that the discouraging truth that the Supreme Court of the United States favors some laws over others and is prepared to do whatever it takes to uphold and assist its favorites. So he thinks that the majority in this case simply was going to do whatever it could to uphold the ACA.
Right. And essentially that's what I'm saying. You know, that yeah. Roberts was going to do what he was going to figure out a way to keep this thing going because, yeah. you know, corporate America wants it. The Chamber of Commerce wants it. You know, they may fund anti-Obamacare talk because they don't like Obama and they don't like Democrats. And but, you know, the fact of the matter is that everybody's making money on this.
And Scalia even went on to also go back and complain about the prior ACA ruling, too, saying, yeah. well, we rewrote it last time when it said it was a penalty and we call it a tax. So right. we're just doing the same thing again. So he took another smack at Roberts there.
Right. Right. Which, in other words, Roberts didn't go far enough when he said states could opt out of Medicaid.
Right.
So very, 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 very interesting stuff. And, you know, at that, I mean, it's just. Now, meanwhile, we're finding that, you know, with austerity, as it were, you know, here in the United States, we have austerity. We're still under the sequester and you know, the Republicans have been advocating austerity since the Reagan administration. Cut back on government. Well, this has been enforced in Europe and at least in those nations. Actually, it's spreading all across the European continent, all across, you know, the European Union, rather. And, I mean, even Germany is cutting back on their social programs. This austerity belief has infected pretty much everybody over there. And this is a fascinating piece published by Julianne Mercel over at truthout.org. A new significant study of the case of Ireland reveals that a total of 500 additional suicides have happened in that country between 2008 and 2012 compared to the number expected had pre-recession trends continued. In other words, austerity is leading to suicides. These insane economic policies that right now the Europeans have been reading too much Hayek or von Mises or Friedman or God only knows what. Conducted by researchers at University College Cork, the study confirms trends observed elsewhere. Another research report estimated more than 1,000 the number of additional suicides in the UK during 2008 to 2010. In Spain, the economic crisis has led to an 8% increase in suicide rates. But look at Greece. Greece right now has an unemployment rate that is worse than it was in 1933 during the depths of the Great Depression. In Greece, reports indicate that suicides have risen by more than 60% since 2007. In the United States, the number of additional suicides between 2008 and 2010 has been estimated at 4,750. So this is like, you know, that study that was published in 2002 by the BBC showing that over 100 years, every time there was a conservative government in the UK, suicides went up. Every time a Labour government came in, a Bernie Sanders kind of government, you know, a liberal government came in, suicides went down. We really, really, really need to make. And the reason I mentioned this in the context of the ACA is that, you know, the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare is part of, it's an imperfect part, I much prefer Medicare for All, but it's part of the social safety net. The original premise of the ACA was everybody gets health care. And in fact, we've got some clips of the president. We'll play those in about 5 minutes when we come back from the next break. But the social safety net is, it should be, and it is in pretty much every other civilized country, you know, just a basic piece of what it means to live in a country. It's you know, here we are, the richest country on earth, or second richest now compared to China, I guess, and in terms of absolute wealth, we're still the richest country on earth, and yet we have tens of millions of people who have no insurance. I mean, and this is of course because of Republican obstructionism in the 20 some odd states that are refusing to expand Medicaid. So, you know, had Medicaid expansion, you know, made it through the Supreme Court a couple of years ago, the ACA would basically be covering everybody in the United States, which would be an amazing thing. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And it's still anything goes summer, but I got a bunch of other stories to share with you, too, as time goes on. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Brian watching Free Speech TV on the web in Fitchburg, Massachusetts. Hey, Brian, what's up? Brian?
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing? I know one way we can lower health care, Get rid of the 80 million illegals in this country that the government's paying health care on. All the farmers have illegals working for them, and we're paying for their health care. That's why we had a war with the South, because they had slave labor. Those farmers don't need illegals working for them. If they can't afford the farm, let somebody else do it.
You know how this came about, Brian? Was
all these factories out in Texas and Massachusetts here. You can't get a job there unless you're a Spanish illegal. That's not right.
I don't disagree, Brian. I think your numbers are off. I don't think there's 80 million undocumented people in the United States. But nonetheless, if you want to know where this problem came from, if you want to define it as a problem, frankly, I think in some ways it is Ronald Reagan. Reagan in 1986 granted amnesty to 5 million people who were in this country without documentation, and then stopped enforcing the law against rich white employers who hired people without documentation. Prior to 1986, the average migration numbers in the United States were a little less than a million people would come from Mexico into the United States, or from, you know, south of the border, let's say, into the United States every year around picking season, summer, fall. And when winter came, around a million people would go back to Mexico. They'd go back south. When Reagan stopped, and the reason why was because there was basically a carve out in the you can't hire an undocumented worker provision for the farmers in California and Oregon and Washington State, by and large. And so people came and they picked vegetables and then they went home. We actually even had a program for this back in the 50s and 60s. It was called the Bracero Program, where we issued them like temporary identity cards when they came in. It didn't work out so well, so they just went back to the wink and the nod system. But outside of agriculture, if an employer hired somebody who did not have documentation, who did not have a green card, the right to work in this country, that employer could go to jail. That employer would face fines. That employer was facing the possibility that their place of business would be shut down. And therefore, meatpacking plants all across this country were paying $30, $40 an hour. They were unionized. There was good work. Construction sites all across this country were paying $30, $40, $50 an hour for you know, good laborers, good, you know, roofers and electricians and whatnot. And now all those wages have collapsed because Reagan said we're no longer going to put the wealthy white corporate employers in jail. We're only going to put the, quote, illegal aliens in jail, which meant that those employers that you're talking about, Brian, in Fitchburg or wherever it may be, those employers are now able to hire people who are here without documentation and know that they're not going to go to jail because nobody has changed the rules since Reagan. I mean, we've just been maintaining it all this time. If you want to see people who are only here for their own economic advantage, who shouldn't be here, go back home. All you have to do is start putting employers in jail, put some rich white guys in jail. But I see no appetite for that in the Republican Party. They absolutely are opposed to that. They want to maintain the Reagan status quo because, as you point out, it is cheap labor. And comprehensive immigration reform, by the way, as proposed by the Obama administration, would go back to the employer enforcement. It would reverse that Reagan doctrine and thus prevent the problem from happening all over again. But nobody seems to want to talk about that part of it. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, a couple of things I wanted to share with you. Apropos of the, not only was the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, upheld today. Well, actually, we've got a couple of clips from President Obama about that. He just, about 40 minutes ago or so, came out and gave a little talk. So here's the first clip from President Obama on the ACA.
5 years ago, after nearly a century of talk, decades of trying, a year of bipartisan debate, we finally declared that in America, health care is not a privilege for a few, but a right for all.
There you go. And then he continued, and, you know, so he kind of divided America into three stages. He said, you know, for a century we have been talking, if Teddy Roosevelt was the first guy to propose Medicare for all, basically, a national health care system. That was like in 1909 or so, 1907. But he said, for over a century we've been talking about this, and 30 years ago, or in the 1930s, two generations ago, he said, Americans decided to protect people in their retirement, and that was Social Security. And he said then a generation ago, and that this was during the Johnson administration, he's counting Democratic administrations, by the way, you know, the Republicans opposed all of these things. Then a generation ago, Americans decided to protect the elderly with regard to their health care, and we got Medicare. And he said, now we're protecting everybody. And then, you know, he said, however, you've got Republicans who are obstructing this in their states. They're refusing to take free money from the federal government simply because they hate Obama. And here's what he had to say about that.
We're making progress. We're going to keep working to get more people covered. I'm going to work as hard as I can to convince more governors and state legislatures to take advantage of the law, put politics aside, and expand Medicaid and cover their citizens. We've still got states out there that, for political reasons, are not covering millions of people that they could be covering, despite the fact that the federal government's picking up the tab.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that happened. Then yesterday, the fast track passed the Senate. It's gone to the president for his signature. He will probably sign it in the dark of night. But, you know, if we step into the Wayback Machine, and a tip of the hat to whoever posted this over on DU a couple days ago. I don't have the original post, so I can't call that person out, but thank you for it. November 10th, 2009. This is in the New York Times. And keep in mind, this was, you know, Barack Obama was president, and this was around the time that they were beginning to negotiate the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, this is where the battle is going, okay? Fast track has passed. So now when these trade bills come before Congress, it's just going to be a straight up or down vote. They can't be amended. They can't be filibustered. But they can still be defeated. Now, the House and Senate are both controlled by Republicans, so it's going to be very difficult to defeat them because the Republicans, you know, are wholly owned subsidiaries of corporate America, the Republican Party, by and large. But this was the thinking at the time. This is an op-ed in the New York Times in their business section on November 10th, 2009. And it's titled American Wages Out of Balance. It's by Edward Hattis, Martin Hutchison, and Anthony Curry. And I don't, you know, interestingly, at the end of the article, it does not say, you know, these guys work for the Cato Institute or these guys, you know, whatever. It just, you know, has their names. But here's what it says. American workers are overpaid relative to equally productive employees elsewhere doing the same work. If the global economy is to get into balance, that gap must close. Now, the first question in my mind is, who cares about the global economy? I mean, it's, you know, there is not a global economy. There are all these national economies that interact with each other in ways that you could call the global economy, but only a transnational corporation would be thinking in terms of, quote, the global economy. And they go on to say this wage gap, the global wage gap has been narrowing. In other words, American wages have been coming down. Isn't that a wonderful thing? And wages in China and Vietnam have been coming up. But recent labor market statistics in the United States suggest the adjustment has not gone far enough. And then they say, and this is just the most outrageous thing that I've seen in years. The big trade deficit is another sign of excessive pay for Americans. Now, let me get this straight. Because we're buying so much cheap junk from China, we are $11 trillion in debt. We had a trade surplus from the George Washington administration until the Reagan administration. We've had trade deficits since the Reagan administration, at equaling $11 trillion. And they're saying this is because our workers are paid too much? I think it's because, you know, we went for so-called free trade. We did away with our tariffs. But anyhow, they say one explanation for the attractive prices of imported goods is that American workers are paid too much relative to their foreign peers. Well, yeah, with no tariffs, with no protection. Now, the Chinese have tariffs. You know, they just busted 40 tons, I think it was, of meat being smuggled into China from Vietnam. Some of it was from the 1980s. Now, this meat could now be shipped into the United States because, you know, we had to do away with our country of origin labeling laws. But, you know, they caught it because China has a tariff on imports. We don't. And then they go on, they say that it's possible to run the numbers to show that American manufacturing workers should take an average real wage cut of as much as 20% to get into global balance. See, this is how these people think who are putting together the TPP.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
In fact, they warn us if American wages get stuck above global market clearing levels, as in the 1930s, the result could be something approaching Depression-era levels on unemployment. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Two bits of Bernie news, by the way. BernieSanders.com is his website. He just issued a news release today because of the Supreme Court's decision to protect the modest gains made under the Affordable Care Act. It's a good day for millions of Americans who will be able to keep their access to health care. He said, while I'm glad the Supreme Court upheld the law, in my view, the only long-term solution to America's health care crisis is a Medicare for all single-payer system. He says, I start my approach with two simple premises. Number one, health care must be recognized as a right, not a privilege. Every man, woman, and child in our country should be able to access quality care regardless of their income. And number two, we must create a national system to provide care for every single American in the most cost-effective way possible. And then Senator Sanders adds, tragically, the United States fails in both areas. The health insurance lobbyists and big pharmaceutical companies should make national health care sound scary. It's not. In fact, a large single-payer system already exists in the United States. It's called Medicare. And you know, it goes on from there. The other thing is, I got an email from Americans for Tax Fairness. And they, along with 40 other national organizations, have just endorsed a piece of legislation that Senator Sanders is introducing today into the United States Senate called the Responsible Estate Tax Act. So that, you know, when the Walton heirs die and when the Koch brothers die, you know, their heirs will get a little bit less. I mean, you've got $100 billion, you know, you can do fine with a little less than that. So, he says, while the top estate tax today is 40%, after exemptions and loopholes, the average tax rate paid is just 17%, according to the Tax Policy Center. President Obama has proposed a top estate tax rate of 45%. Anyhow, it goes on. So here's where it gets interesting. Bill Maher, one of my favorite comedians and political commentators, I mean, he's really become both. Bill Maher had both Bernie Sanders and Ann Coulter on his program last Friday. And in the extended segment, this did not happen on the air, but it's over at the website for HBO. You can watch it. You know, they have this extended segment of that's just on the Internet, something that we should think about doing, by the way. I think that would be really cool. But in any case, they have this extended segment, and Bill Maher gets into a rather serious conversation with Ann Coulter about who could win the presidency. And she comes to a very, very startling conclusion. This is just the two of them talking in the, you know, in the after section. Here it is, this is from HBO On Demand.
Scott Walker, would you say?
Of the ones who aren't declared, no, I'm Romney Walker's my ticket.
Romney Walker. See, but last time you said if we nominate Romney, we'll definitely lose.
And I was right. But
well, why will he win this?
That was two
third
years
time's the
in
charm?
Advance, and it was because actually third time was the charm for Reagan.
Right.
It was because it's very hard to take out an incumbent, and the reason I supported Christie back then, and I don't now, was because, you know, he's so flashy and idiosyncratic that we probably were going to lose, but the only shot we had was this wild, idiosyncratic guy. I think Romney would crush Hillary.
I would do anything for
Trump.
If
you ran Bernie Sanders, it would be much tougher.
Bernie Sanders?
It would be much tougher to beat him.
You think would be a better candidate than Hillary?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean,
because he would
cares
excite
about
the base.
The American middle class, working class. Hillary doesn't. She's like the
Ooh.
Elected Republican. She cares about the Chamber of Commerce.
There you go. Ann Coulter telling Bill Maher, seriously, not joking, that she thinks that a Romney Walker ticket would be the ideal Republican ticket. And I suspect, frankly, that she's right. Scott Walker's got the, you know, he brings along the Koch brothers and the billions, you know, of dollars and, you know, just to spend on an election. And Mitt Romney, I think, has, you know, he's got some street cred now. He lost. And she's, you know, she said, you know, Reagan tried three times, finally won. The possibility of Romney is the same. And I think Romney could really give Hillary Clinton a run for her money. And a lot of Americans would just kind of tune out. They'd go, okay, you know, rich guy versus rich woman and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Wall Street versus Wall Street. But I think that she's right. I don't think that Mitt Romney and Scott Walker could beat Bernie Sanders. I really don't. And it's amazing to be in agreement with Ann Coulter on anything. But anyway. By the way, last thing, and then I'm going to pick up your phone calls here. Have you seen this website, isidewith.com? isidewith.com/political quiz, actually, is the... in fact, I wonder if the political-quiz part, if I take that out, where do I go? Yeah. Yeah, okay, yeah. isidewith.com. And they say 15 million voters have used this to find their candidate match. And basically what they do is they list all these issues, and you just click in your position on the issues. And the reason I note this is I saw a post over on DU this morning where a guy said, you know, a friend of mine is a Republican, and he went to isidewith.com and put in his position on all the issues. He's a Republican. And it turns out that Bernie Sanders is his candidate. Wow. Yeah, yeah. Seriously. So, you know, check it out, isidewith.com. So that said, Michael in West Palm Beach, Florida. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, good morning. How you doing? I just want to make a quick comment about Scalia and his SCOTUS care comment.
Mm-hmm. SCOTUS care. This is what Drudge and the right are calling it now. Instead of Obamacare, they're calling it SCOTUS care.
Yeah. But here's my question. He made a comment about how the Supreme Court is picking and choosing laws. My question is, does he read his Citizen United?
Right.
And where he made up a law?
Yeah.
That wasn't even a law?
I know. He made up a doctrine, and then he put it into law, yeah.
Yeah, so does he not understand that you can go back and read these things?
Well, it's really interesting because Scalia's dissent was basically, you know, we shouldn't be making law. We should just be interpreting law. And Scalia, of course, was all over Citizens United. And Scalia on the bench was on the bench for Bush v. Gore, too, which, you know, was not even in the interpretation of a law. It was a simple lawsuit. So, yeah, Michael, excellent point. Excellent point. Thanks a lot for the call. Wayne in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. Hey, Wayne, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a quick comment about what a mess I find Obamacare to be. I have a health plan under Obamacare. Well, actually, for the last several years before that, I was self-employed. So I kind of know what it's like to be out on the market and get a plan. The biggest issue that I'm finding right now is whenever I've had to use it, and I don't use it much, in addition to my copayment, I get endless bills that fall under the category of co-insurance.
Yeah.
And so you do your co-payment and you think you're okay, and then these bills start flying in, and when you try to appeal the bills, of course you go to level one and level two hearings, and the people on
the hearing board, what's your health insurance company, Wayne?
I'm with probably the largest healthcare company in New Mexico. You know, I guess I'll just say they have a religious sounding name.
Yeah.
Rather than
name. Well, you can say the name. There's no problem with that.
Oh, Presbyterian.
Presbyterian. Okay, I'm unfamiliar with
them. Yeah, they're just...
I know that, you know, we have a friend who has a small business, and they just moved from Blue Cross Blue Shield to United Healthcare. And, boy, what a difference. The Blue Cross Blue Shield was paying bills for healthcare and for pretty much everything. United Healthcare basically challenges everything. Every single time somebody submits a claim, they say no, and then you got to fight them on everything. And this is how Stephen J. Hemsley has become, you know, worth over $1 billion. He's the CEO of United Healthcare. This is the problem with Obamacare, Wayne, is that it depends on private insurance companies to deliver the goods. It basically inserts banksters between us and our healthcare providers. Now, that's the problem with the system that we had, you know, for 100 years before Obamacare, too. And this is why Bernie Sanders is saying, get the banksters out of the business, because these health insurance companies are actually banksters. All they do is handle money, and they do it very selectively, and they do it in ways that are designed to increase their profits regardless of the health consequences to you or to me. And that's why we need to go with a system where there's no profit motive, there's no banksters in the middle. And that's what Bernie is suggesting, is just let everybody in America enroll in Medicare. And Medicare runs on a 3% overhead rather than 15, 20, 25, 30% overhead that you see with some of these health insurance companies. And the way that and that overhead is actually, you know, inflated salaries for their CEOs, marketing costs, dividends to their stockholders, you know, fancy headquarters, all this kind of stuff. We don't need this industry. Other countries function just fine without even having that industry. Or you shrink that industry down to the size where it's basically just for wealthy people who want to be able to have, quote, an insurance, a health insurance policy that will make sure that they get, you know, a private room, you know, or they get flown about in a private jet if they get sick or something. And, you know, let them pay the $30,000 or $50,000 a year for Ted Cruz's wife. Was a Wall Street banker, and she was getting her health insurance, as I recall, cost $44,000 a year. And he, you know, it's like it's incredible. And then she stopped working there, and so I think he went on Obamacare. I think Ted Cruz did. No, he took the.
I don't know.
Oh, he changed his mind.
I do have a follow up question too.
Yeah.
My follow up question is this, Tom. If you do have a bone spur removed from your foot, it's uncomfortable. You go to in-network care, and it's a day surgery. What do you think should be, just guessing off the top of your head, the price for a procedure like that? What should be the
I don't have a clue. The one thing I do know is it's going to cost twice as much in the United States as it will in any other developed country. What do they charge you?
$3,300.
Well, that's not that, you know, I was expecting, you know, five figures, not four. But Wayne, thanks a lot for the call. It's not perfect. Nobody's claiming it's perfect. You know, Obamacare, there should have been a public option. Medicare should have been one of the options. And hopefully, if we get a Democratic president and we can flip the Senate and the House, which I think is possible, we can do that.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But as long as Republicans are in charge of Congress, don't hold your breath. We'll be back 15 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Bruce, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in St. Petersburg, Florida. Bruce, you are on the air. What's up?
Yes, hello, Tom. Glad to speak to you. One item is, your first caller, I believe, that said something about the Hispanic people and how many there was here in the United States.
Right.
My wife worked as a nurse in a hospital in California. I lived in California for 30 years. And one of the assistants that cleaned up a nursing she cleaned the beds and everything.
Right.
I was talking to her one day about it, everybody coming up here. And she goes, well, they're recruiting down here in Mexico. There's places, there's people that, you know, are recruiting for different companies up here in the United States that if you can get up here, you're guaranteed a job. And they show you, just like in Walmart, how to get on the state's, you know, welfare or food stamps, stuff like this. And there's actually companies, I think this has been brought up a lot before, recruiting.
Yeah, we've talked about this before, Bruce. There's actually a newspaper. There are newspapers that are published in the border towns in Mexico with ads for meatpacking companies, construction sites, whatnot around the United States, help wanted ads that are being distributed in Mexico. And this is my whole point. You know, before Reagan stopped enforcing the employer sanctions, is what it was called. Before he stopped enforcing those, employers were afraid to hire people who were here without documentation because the employers would go to jail. And so, you know, we had very, very few people coming here and staying here. We had people coming to visit. We had people coming to work for a short period of time, principally in agriculture where that there was functionally an exception to that rule. But that was pretty much it. But when Reagan's, after he granted amnesty to 5 million people, he said, okay, and by the way, we're not going to send any more employers to jail. We're all about business. We love business. We support business. And so now undocumented immigrants who are here illegally and are living every day in fear that they will be arrested and imprisoned and deported, those folks are now living in a situation where the employers are free to exploit them, to threaten them, to abuse them. In the case of women, to rape them. I mean, you know, this is not at all uncommon. There are all these reports of this, and it's all because we're not enforcing employer sanctions. And if we were to enforce employer sanctions as part of a comprehensive immigration reform, we, you know, definitely any kid who has been born here and people who came here as young people, you know, the Dreamers, by all means, you know, make them citizens quickly. And there's a lot of productive capacity there, but we've got to, you know, every country has to have control of its labor markets. It's that simple.
And I just want to say one more comment. I knew a guy that they had a big shoe company. They made the shoes in China,
Right.
He flew over there at least once a month to check up on it. His dad did. And then they'd ship all the shoes over here. They were stamped USA, not made in, but USA on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to pick up my friend that worked there. And we had to go through the company to get to the back place where they parked. And I looked in this one room, and here sat like two dozen Hispanic girls. And they were taking shoestrings and putting them in the shoes. They were gluing on stars and stripes and all kinds of stuff to the shoes. And he says, well, that's how they claim they're made here.
Right. It's really assembled in the United States, some parts made outside the United States. Dell Computer was doing that for a while. I'm guessing they still are. It was maybe 4 or 5 years ago we did a show on it, kind of an expose. They were making basically everything for the computers in Mexico, shipping them across the border to Dallas, where they then put the boards inside the cabinets and then put, you know, assembled in the United States on them. Bruce, thanks for the call. We'll be back. Anything goes summer. By the way, Congressman Mark Pocan will be with us at the top of the next hour. Thomas in Flint, Michigan. Hey, Thomas, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. I'm very serious with this. I want to preface this. I see that we're winning with the Confederate flag, where it's starting to be taken down, and people are starting to get serious about that discussion. We've won with Obamacare, with the rulings. Can we have a serious debate and discussion about repealing and replacing the Second Amendment? I'm dead on serious.
Yeah.
Because after learning from what you said that it may be on, what it may be really about. And,
right. It was originally put in place to protect the slave patrols in Virginia. That's you know.
Exactly. So can we have an honest debate about doing that, so maybe we could get past and have reasonable gun control and gun safety and everything else, so if people do want to have a gun, they can, and it's not this free-for-all?
Yeah, if we're going to do that, we've got to get past, you know, a Supreme Court decision saying that they discovered in, what was the name of the case, Hiller? Heller? Yeah. Heller, where they discovered an individual right to own arms the Second Amendment is one of the few, I think it's one of two places in the Constitution where the word regulation is used, a well-regulated militia. You know, in other words, it's you can read it a couple of different ways. And one way that historically it had been read before Heller was that, you know, the word regulated meant that the United States had the power to regulate guns. And, you know, then the Supreme Court came along and said, no, we're going to go along with the gun manufacturers. You got no right to regulate these things. And so now we are 5% of the world's population. We have 44% of the world's civilian-owned handguns. And we have a gun death rate in the United States among civilians 25 times higher than any other developed country in the world. So I don't disagree with you, Thomas. I think, you know, having a serious discussion either about repealing the Second Amendment or, you know, if and when the nature of the Supreme Court changes, which will just be a couple of years down the road, if there's a Democrat in the White House, whether it's Bernie or whether it's Hillary Clinton, it won't matter. I think, you know, somebody good will get appointed to the Supreme Court, and then they could reexamine Heller. And because Heller was really a reexamination of a previous case, which I definitely can't remember the name of, which had basically said, no, states can regulate guns. So, you know, yeah, I think it's time for a great time for that conversation. Thomas, thanks for the call. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, thanks for listening to KBCS. What's up?
Are you there, Tom?
I am. Are you there?
Okay, good. Yeah, I was a little break up there.
Okay.
So, yeah, the decision today is, I guess it's a good decision. But as you pointed out, we still have American insurance companies running our healthcare system. I'm here in Michigan visiting my folks, and my mom gets The Economist magazine, and there was an article in The Economist 2 weeks ago, I think it was, we were reading, talked about the Medicare Part D prescription drug program that Bush and the Republicans passed in 2005. It took effect in 2006, and that this was a big lobbying effort by the pharmaceutical companies.
Right. It's a $600 billion per decade subsidy to them.
And here's the deal. They spent the whole idea of the Medicare Part D idea was on the pharmaceutical companies. They were the ones who came up with it because they wanted to insert themselves into an American institution, Medicare.
Right.
And what they did, they spent, it says here in the article, they spent $130 million in lobbying. And as of now, 9 years later, since it's taken effect, they've already profited $240 billion.
Right. That's a hell of a return on investment. It's just like you look at the amount of money that the people who just voted for Fast Track got when the lobbying efforts kicked up. And there was a piece in back in March, I think. Bob Ney emailed it to me, in fact, yesterday. From The Guardian that talked about how much each one of these members were getting. And they were getting like $50,000, $100,000, $200,000, you know, to vote for Fast Track. It's amazing how cheap it is to buy off our legislators. It's just astonishing.
Right. It's, and, the thing that really makes me angry is that now every skyrocketing cost in healthcare is being blamed on Obamacare. Now, we have drugs that part of the lobbying of the Medicare Part D bill was that Medicare could not negotiate any drug prices. So we basically are operating, our Medicare Part D is operating under a trust of the drug companies.
Right.
They're essentially a monopoly that Medicare has to deal with. And that not only, that's just for the Medicare recipients, say no negotiating, but also for everybody that they allowed, this bill allowed the drug companies to rebrand generics. And they have raised prices. I mean, I'll give you an example. I carry a little puffer inhaler in my pocket for asthma that I've had since I was a kid. And this albuterol that I used to buy in 1980, I'd pay $6 for it. And even a year before Med D came in, I could buy it online. An inhaler was $13 online. Last year, the inhaler was $54. This year, the inhaler is $135.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, and this is because the generic companies are being bought up by the brand name companies.
It's a generic it's been a generic for 50 years.
Right.
But they rebranded it in 2009, and it has gone steadily up. We got to kick these private drug companies and insurance companies out of our healthcare system.
Right.
Because I got to tell you, Tom, it's not just progressives like me who have asthma. Lots of conservative Republicans have all kinds of, and everybody's paying through the nose for these things.
Yeah,
I mean, this is why Medicare Part D. Mom pays more now. She pays almost half of her drug costs because every year the Med D program, the premiums go up. They have, not only they have a donut hole, which she's in every year, they have a deductible.
Right.
So they got a pre-donut hole, and of course, then you pay. They cover a little bit, and then every year she's in the donut hole by September. So she's on, you know, expensive heart medication. My mom was a nurse for 65 years, and she's got heart problems and arthritis from being on her feet all her life. And now she has to pay, from September through the end of the year, she has to pay out of her pocket.
Right. This is nuts. This is just plain old flat out nuts, Paul. And I totally agree with you. And that's why I think that Ann Coulter said that even if the ticket is Romney Walker on the Republican side, which would be hard in her opinion and in my opinion for Hillary Clinton to beat, that Bernie Sanders would eat their lunch, because Bernie Sanders is talking about fixing exactly what you're talking about. He opposed Medicare Part D for that exact reason. Paul, thank you for the call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as TV by the Free Speech TV Network on Dish, Direct, and cable systems nationwide. Welcome back. Congressman Mark Pocan is on the line with us. Brilliantly representing the second district of Wisconsin. His website, Pocan, P-O-C-A-N, .house.gov. Congressman, welcome back.
Well, thank you very much, Tom.
It's great to have you with us. First of all, I'm curious your thoughts on the Affordable Care Act that just passed.
You know, we're just really glad. We've been told all along that we felt very confident in the legal standing on it, and now that's been confirmed, and now we have to make states like my home state of Wisconsin make Governor Walker quit worrying about running for president and do something for the people of Wisconsin and take the Medicaid expansion money and let's embrace this. So we now have the Supreme Court decision. Let's move forward.
Yeah, it seems to me like there's a couple of steps here. The first one that need to be done, the first one is to make sure that these Republican-controlled states that are trying to keep this, and by the way, all, as Paul Krugman pointed out, all but one of them were slaveholding states, that these Republican-held states that are refusing to expand Medicare, Medicaid, do so, number one. Number two, that we fix Medicare Part D so that the government can negotiate for drug prices, because that's rippling all across everything. It's
absolutely,
you know, and that industry has made $20 billion now since they spent $170 million lobbying for that and hiring Billy Towson. And number three is to fix Obamacare by adding a public option to it, the option of buying into Medicare as, you know, as opposed to getting your health care from an insurance company. Your thoughts?
You know, we've had that in our Progressive Caucus version of the budget, specifically on the a public option. In fact, we would probably fix the excise tax that affects some of you know, workers' plans through their unions, and you could easily fund that through a public option and expand health care even more. So we've been advocating for that, and now we can kind of maybe move forward with the law rather than keep looking back and trying to vote on its repeal and saying it's not constitutional because it's now passed the right muster to do that.
Right. So on the original topic that we booked you on, which is the fast track and TPP and all these trade deals, the Trade Promotion Authority, also known as Fast Track, has passed both the House and Senate and gone to the White House for signature. Do I have that right?
Yeah, just the final, the TAA, along with AGOA, the African Trade Bill, just passed the House, which we expected it to, and actually we all did support at this point. But really, we realized it's time to pivot to the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yeah.
That, you know, now that we've got it, that we're not going to have any direct say through amending it, and we're going to have a very limited debate. We've got to do everything we can now to try to hold them accountable for what they told us as they said they wanted our votes.
Right. So the TAA has already passed the Senate, has it?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, and it just passed the House. So now
everything now is on its way to the White House. The president will sign both TPA and TAA along with the AFCA trade bill. I think the only thing that's kind of out there still is the customs bill, where some of the amendments that Republicans put on in order to get Republican votes for TPA. For example, Jim Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin had an amendment that's saying you can't have any climate change treaty within the agreement. What's going to be interesting is if that stuff is true, and we saw a letter from Ambassador Froman, their U.S. Trade Representative, saying there will be no climate change treaty within here. We got some explaining to do from the administration because we've also been told other things about what was in there around climate change, and I've seen some things in a classified setting I can't explicitly say, but we do need clarification on what that amendment means and other amendments that took away the human trafficking provisions that the Senate had in there specifically about Malaysia, took away some of the currency provisions.
Right.
Some things that actually made it better are now not in there, and we got to find out how that's going to move forward.
Is it possible that when so now basically the skids have been greased, right? If one of these so-called trade deals, even though most of what they deal with is not trade, it's restructuring the international economy.
Yeah.
If one of these bills, let's say TPP as a starting point, then there's TTIP, the transatlantic one coming up, and then the TISA, the one in services. If any of these come up, they actually do have to be revealed to the public for what, 60 days before they're voted on?
Yes, 60 days is what it's supposed to be. But now we have just given up our authority for the next 6 years on any future trade agreement to have the ability to amend or to we're going to have limited debate. So we just gave it to this president, the next president, and potentially the next president on any future trade deal. We now have shut ourselves out.
Right. But in the process, I mean, it can still be defeated by a 50% vote. Now, this is going to require large numbers of Republican defections. But do you think that when the actual content of the TPP becomes evident, that there will be the same kind of groundswell there was around, for example, net neutrality, where Tom Wheeler, the former lobbyist for the telecom industry, the head of the FCC, was, you know, gung-ho not to have net neutrality. And then all of a sudden, you know, 4 million people dropped petitions on his desk and he changed his mind. I mean, is it possible that we can still defeat TPP when it comes forward?
I really believe that. I just overheard a Republican on the floor not 20 minutes ago tell someone, I voted against TPA because 95% of the people in my district were against it. We really got hit hard by NAFTA. So when you hear that, and if we can, you know, make sure that once we see this language, if it's going to be what I know it's going to be, because I've already went three times into a classified room and saw what's already negotiated, we see how bad it is. then the people who said, well, give the White House the benefit of the doubt, see if they can negotiate a better deal, we'll know we don't have a better deal. And at that point, we can be very concrete. And I think the fact that some of these amendments that got put on, you know, climate change is either going to be in it or it's not going to be in it, but you can't play it both ways. And right now, I think it's being played both ways because allegedly, you know, you didn't have the final document. We'll have the final document and we'll know whether they were telling us the truth or someone else the truth, but that may also bring some votes in.
So you're talking about this ban on, you know, any kind of international climate change activity. Was that associated with the TPA with Fast Track?
That was an amendment put on in order to get votes for TPA, and Jim Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin put out a press release saying, hey, look, this passed, and I got a letter from Ambassador Froman saying, don't worry, there won't be any climate change treaties within here. But I can tell you that's different than conversations we've had. So we want clarity on this because, again, I think in the end, someone was lied to. We just got to figure out who it is and whose votes that moves.
So
have things to affect climate change and say you're not going to in the same.
So document. The bill that went to the fast track authority that went to the president actually had it was conditional. Like this applies to trade treaties that, but it doesn't apply to trade treaties that contain, for example, international agreement on climate change.
Well, it said you can't have within the Trans-Pacific Partnership anything about climate change. Now that's an amendment in the customs bill. And that potentially, that still has to go through the Senate and could, through a conference committee, be potentially removed.
Oh, okay. So this is a separate piece of legislation.
Tell me which, but it's all part and parcel. We had four votes that were all part of this vote. It was the customs vote, yeah, the TPA, the TAA, and then the AGOA. But, you know, how many Republicans are going to say, no, I think we should have climate change language in here? So, you know, some of those have a good chance of staying. And if they stay, then what does that mean to those of us who've been promised that this environmental chapter is not worse than previous environmental chapters?
Right. It means we've been lied to once again.
Someone has been lied to.
Yeah. Geez. When do you expect the TPP is going to get dropped, Congressman?
We don't know that exactly. You know, we all assumed it'd be before the end of the year. We know that, you know, when you get to the August break, things are a little tougher to move unless they have great consensus because of the presidential election. I would find it hard to believe that it could come in the next month, but, you know, if some people are talking, they think it could. I just, from what I've seen in a classified setting without saying any of the particulars, there are still a number of things to be resolved with, you know, you think about it, there's countries like Malaysia and Vietnam that don't have a lot in common with some of the other countries that are in the trade deal.
Right.
And I just would be surprised if it happened in the next
month. Do you think it's possible that Congress will simply wait until after the next election, until November of next year, and then just after the election, as they have done, by the way, in the past with a number of things, you know, during the Christmas recess, this is the end, it's a lame duck session of Congress, and a new president is coming in, has not yet taken office, and at that point they would drop it and pass it?
What I can tell you is from what I watched in the last few weeks, anything is possible.
Anything's possible. Brilliant. Congressman Mark Pocan, one of the best members of the U.S. House of Representatives, representing the 2nd District of Wisconsin. His website, Pocan, P-O-C-A-N, .house.gov. Congressman, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Thank you, sir.
Great talking with you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour, and of course, since anything goes summer, I got a few other things to share with you, too, as time goes on. Stick around. Welcome back. Brandy in Lansing, Michigan. Hey, Brandy, what's on your mind? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Good afternoon, Tom. Give me one moment. Let me take you off speaker, please.
Certainly. Hello?
Thank you. Sorry about that.
That's
quite all right. Thank you for your patience there.
Sure.
Well, always, always good to talk to you. I was reading an article yesterday in the New York Times by a Thomas B. Edsel about individuality.
I read it. In fact, I've got it printed out here. I was going to riff on it a little bit.
What did you think? Because it was insidious, but yet it makes so much sense.
Yeah, yeah.
You have this individuality glamorized by our older baby boomer compadres. And now we're left with the mean streets.
Right. The article is titled, "Why Don't
Men."
The article is titled, "Why Don't the Poor Rise Up?" And in it, he talks about he's quoting a professor of sociology at the University of California, David Snow, and he's talking about and Jacob Hacker as well. He says, and Ulrich Beck. He says Ulrich Beck, a German sociologist who died earlier this year, noted the obstructions to collective social action In 2002, in his book Individualization, he wrote that those who in the past saw coworkers as colleagues and allies now face competitive pressures, such as when a shared background still exists, community is dissolved in the acid bath of competition. I would say I could boil Thomas Edsel's column down to very simple terms. When the labor market is tight, when there is competition among employers for employees, wages go up and workers have power, unions form, and you've got, you know, a situation where the poor do rise up. On the other hand, when the labor market is very loose, when there are far more workers than there are jobs, then it's very easy for corporations to pit worker against worker and to get rid of unions, and as we've seen basically since the 80s. And the thing in the United States, the two major things that have contributed to the labor market being very, very loose right now are, number one, insane trade policies. That's 80% of it at least. The fact that we no longer have tariffs and we allow, you know, stuff from cheap labor countries to come into the United States, where essentially U.S. workers are essentially no longer competing even with each other. They're competing with 56 cents an hour, you know, maximum or minimum wage in Vietnam, and a country that outlaws trade unions. And two, the fact that we no longer sanction employers from hiring people who are not U.S. citizens. So whether it's the ski resorts in Vermont and New Hampshire hiring Europeans, or whether it's meatpacking plants and construction outfits all across the Midwest hiring people from south of our southern border, from Central and South America, that's diluting our labor markets, our labor pools as well. And so I don't think that individualism is the problem. I think that individualism is the consequence of a loose labor market combined with weird right-wing ideologies. Does that make sense, Brandy?
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
so
thank you, sir, for your input.
You're welcome.
You felt about that.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, I think Edsel is, I think he's straining at a gnat, right? It's like all these people trying to figure out. He starts out talking about legitimate grounds for grievance. In fact, I'll riff on this in a little bit right after the break. Stick around. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Thomas Edsel, Brandy from Lansing just brought this up, and it's worth revisiting. In fact, it was one of the things I was going to get into at some length today. By the way, apropos of none of this, I just got the Planet Proctor newsletter. This is from Phil Proctor from the Firesign Theater, and he says that, here we go, Phil Austin died of heart failure last Friday at his home on Fox Island, Washington, after a protracted bout of cancer. Phil Austin, who I've met, I believe, I know I've seen him perform, one of the Firesign Theater's group. And he's got some really funny jokes in here. But in any case, just so you know, firesigntheater.com, I think, is the website. So Thomas Edsel asks, why are today's working poor so quiescent? I'm not the only one posing this question. In The Economist, David Samuels says, why aren't the poor storming the barricades? Why aren't voters demanding more redistribution of wealth? Why aren't Americans doing more to protest inequality, was the headline of the National Catholic Reporter. And Edsel suggests that there are a couple of reasons. He says, number one, poverty isn't as bad as it used to be, in part because the cost of many goods have come down, televisions, computers, air conditioners, household appliances, cell phones. In other words, we're getting cheap junk from China. Number two, he says people are marrying later and therefore they're postponing the financial demand to better earning years. And third, he says some economists contend that commonly used inflation measures result in excessively high estimates of the real world cost of goods. I don't think it's any of those things. I think those are all the symptoms of the larger problem. And the larger problem is the reason that working people in the United States are not rising up en masse, and although they may at the ballot box, particularly if Bernie is the Democratic nominee, but the reason that they're not rising up en masse right now is because, and Edsel talks about this, basically workers are being pitted against each other in the United States. Now, again, that's a symptom of the problem. He thinks that he suggests that this is something called individualization. He's quoting Ulrich Beck, a German sociologist, and he basically says that, you know, when people who see themselves as friends, neighbors, and colleagues because they all work together suddenly are no longer working together but competing for the same jobs, they start viewing themselves as individuals rather than as a community, and this is why mass movements don't form. I don't disagree with that, but I think that what is causing this is the fact that our labor markets are loose. There are too many people chasing too few jobs. This is also known as unemployment. As Bernie Sanders points out, real unemployment in the United States is closer to 11% in minority community. In African-American community, it's over 20%. In the African-American youth community, it's over 50%. Too many people chasing too many jobs. Now, why is that? And now we're getting to the real nub of things. And this is why Ann Coulter told Bill Maher, I believe, why Ann Coulter told Bill Maher that Bernie Sanders could beat even Mitt Romney or Scott Walker. And because Bernie's the only guy saying this, who's running for president as a Democrat, is our insane trade policies. We used to have trade policies whose first and foremost purpose was to protect American workers and whose second primary purpose was to protect American strategic interests. So we had tariffs, import taxes on goods imported into the United States that reflected the difference of manufacturing costs from a low wage or a low environmental standards country compared with us. So if they could make something, you know, here you make a pair of shoes, the example I always use, if you can make a pair of shoes in Connecticut with a dollar's worth of labor, and you can make them in China with 20 cents worth of labor, or you can make them in Mexico with 50 cents worth of labor, when they come in from Mexico, there's a 50 cent tax. When they come in from China, there's an 80 cent tax. So no matter where you buy those shoes from, it's going to cost the labor cost is going to be a dollar. And so the manufacturers, as long as that was the case, and that was the case in the George Washington administration until the Reagan administration, as long as that's the case, then you just keep making things in the United States. I mean, why bother moving a factory overseas when the cost to manufacture something is going to be identical? So, number one, our trade policies we've gone insane. China still has tariffs. They protect their domestic market. Japan has tariffs. They have not just tariffs, Taiwan, South Korea, all of the European countries, they don't just have tariffs. They have VAT taxes that they use that are functional tariffs that run anywhere from 17 to 30%. They have the country of origin labeling and requirements. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that's going on all around the world where countries are acting in their own best interest, except for the United States. Why is this? Because the Supreme Court in 1976 said any billionaire who wants, any corporation who wants, can buy a politician. And so we see that these politicians, for example, who voted for Fast Track just yesterday, almost without exception, and there's a great piece in the Guardian, about this just a few months ago, we're getting tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign contributions, and millions of dollars was spent lobbying for it. But it's really cheap to buy politicians relative to the amount of profit that you can make, which is why this town is awash in money. So that's problem number one. And problem number two is that when Reagan did his amnesty, he also stopped enforcing employer sanctions. So we have basically thrown open the doors for the last 40 years and said anybody who wants to come to the United States from any country, and it's whether it's, like I said, Europeans coming to work as ski instructors in the Northeast or in Colorado, or whether it's, you know, people coming to work in factories or meatpacking plants or whatever, or construction sites. We now have this exploitable labor pool, people who are here illegally or without documentation, and therefore the employers, knowing that ever since Reagan, no employer was going to be put in jail for breaking these rules about only hiring people who are American citizens or who have, you know, green cards, work permits, the employers no longer go to jail, so the employers are hiring these people like there's no tomorrow. In fact, they run ads in Mexican newspapers looking for work, looking for laborers. And they got nothing to worry about. We need comprehensive immigration reform that respects the people who are already here, in particular the young people who came to this country and people who have been born here. It respects them and their families, keeps their families intact, but puts an end to the incentive for more people to come to this country. In other words, we start putting some white, rich business people in jail And, you know, between having a reasonable trade policy and a reasonable labor policy, we could tighten our labor markets again.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Now, here's the rub. You tighten your labor markets, and the poor will rise up. You will see a rise in unionization. You will see a rise in wages. And that's why the corporations don't want it to happen. Helping you win the water cooler wars. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, cue the If I Only Had a Brain. No, I can't sing that well. Okay, an Indiana man was arrested on Sunday for trespassing after he was licking a toad around the parking lot of a local bar. After he left the bar, witnesses said Mullins began dancing around the parking lot. He picked up a toad and started licking it. Now, why would anyone lick a toad? Well, it turns out toads actually have, in their skin, there's a compound called bufotenin. This is not part of the news story. This is just something I remember from years ago. And bufotenin is a hallucinogen. The problem is that in the toad's skin, bufotenin is usually combined with other alkaloids that are really bad for you. They can kill you. And so what you have to do is you have to go back to what were they called? Alchemists? Herbalists, I mean, you know, the old recipes, actually the quote witches, you know, there were recipes for making hallucinogenic brews that were therapeutic. And one of them involved taking a toad's skin and putting it under a rock for a month and then taking it out and making it, an infusion out of it, a tea out of it, and drinking that. And the reason you've got to take the toad's skin and set it under a rock for a month is that the bufotenin will not degrade. It doesn't break down. But the other alkaloids that are so deadly to you or dangerous to you do break down over time, you know, just as a result of the decaying of the flesh of the toad's skin. And so, anyhow, this guy, Mullins, had a blank look on his face. And they gave him a warning, and he walked away. A few minutes later, however, Mullins returned to the parking lot holding another toad. And so they arrested him for misdemeanor trespass. Very interesting. He only knew half the formula, so you gotta do your research, right? And I remember this from when I was a teenager. I learned all about bufotenin. It's one of the probably one of the few psychoactive substances I've never tried. Never came across it, and I had never had any interest in stripping a toad of its skin and letting it rot for a month. But I do remember reading the old books about it. Ray in McHenry, Illinois. Hey Ray, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'd like to try to share a couple of reframes I think might help us in our battles here. One is for TPP, transnational profits over people, transnational profits over patriotism, transnational profits over protection. So
that's great. Yeah, those are great acronyms.
Another one is if a political ad is an act of free speech, isn't the act of voting itself also an act of free speech? And isn't the act of voting also a way for people to peacefully assemble to petition their government for a redress of grievances by voting incumbents out of office? And, you know, people fight all kinds of restrictions against guns because of the Second Amendment. Those same people are trying to limit people's right to vote, and which would be an act of free speech, I would think, too.
That's a really interesting argument. If somebody who was disenfranchised, they were not allowed to vote, because of, for example, one of Scott Walker's laws or one of Texas's laws. You know, they've got a student ID from a state university. They can, you know, they are a citizen, but they don't have a concealed carry permit. So they, you know, in Texas, you can't vote with a student ID, but you can vote with a concealed carry permit because more Republicans have concealed carry permits. Students are more likely to be Democrats. And so if one of those students or, you know, for example, an elderly person who no longer drives or an urban person like me who doesn't own a car, if one of those people was to sue the Secretary of State of Texas or Wisconsin or, you know, name your state, you know, Republican controlled state with voter suppression laws based on the right of assembly. That would be fascinating because it's not you don't just have the right to assemble. You have the right to assemble to petition your government for redress of grievances. And how is voting not a dimension of that? That's a fascinating argument.
Yeah. Well, that's why I threw it out. Two other quick ones here because I know that people are waiting. I think we need to give what Republicans routinely do a name, and I like to call it the pot calling the kettle black strategy. They accuse Democrats and Obama of doing exactly what they're doing.
Yeah.
And they do it often and do it first. Like, you know, accusing him of redistributing wealth, or now they're accusing Clinton of having pay to play when they're accepting billions of dollars from billionaires.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't disagree, although I don't like the metaphor. It's come to have a bit of a racial tinge to it.
Well, yeah, I know. That's the other problem. So, one last thing. You know that concept of you have a right?
Ray, you still there? Ray, I think I just lost you. Hopefully it's not our phone system going down. Hopefully it's just Ray's phone. Susan in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hey, Susan, can you hear me? Susan in Knoxville? No, let's try Tom in Tucson, Arizona. Tom, can you hear me? Uh-oh, I think the Comcast just killed us again. Sylvia in Mountain View, Missouri, do you hear me? We lost our internet. Scott in Tallahassee, Florida. Chris in Darlington, South Carolina. Internet's gone, okay. If you are... I'm going to shut my call screening software so Danielle can reboot when the internet comes back up. But, you know, this is, you know, one of the problems with not being able to have a choice of internet providers is that, you know, we have one option in this building, and it's a Comcast, Xfinity, whatever they call it, and it is insanely unreliable. And as you hear on this program, it is just absolutely insanely unreliable. And that is not a good thing. So, anyway, I don't know if you saw this. This was in, I told you about Phil Proctor's newsletter, Proctor Planet, which if you go to firesigntheater.com or funnytimes.com, you can check it out. There's a Dear Abby column in here. And Jim, can you move over to this camera, please? There's a Dear Abby column in here, and it's hysterical. Dear Abby, my husband is a liar and a cheat. He has cheated on me from the beginning, and when I confront him, he denies everything. What's worse, everyone knows that he cheats on me. It's so humiliating. Also, since he lost his job 14 years ago, he hasn't even looked for a new one. All he does all day is smoke cigars, cruise around, and shoot the bull with his buddies while I have to work to pay the bills. Since our daughter went away to college, he doesn't even pretend to like me and even hints I may be a lesbian. What should I do? Signed, Clueless. This is a pretty tasteless joke. Maybe I shouldn't. Oh, well. Dear Clueless, says Abby. This is in Phil's. Phil's a comedian. Grow up and dump him. You don't need him anymore. Good grief, woman. You're running for president of the United States. I think that even he hints that I'm a lesbian part is going too far, though. That's the old right-wing talking point. Anyway, there are a number of things that I wanted to share with you today. Let me go back to this American wages are out of balance thing. The article in 2009 in the business section of the New York Times basically was saying it's time for Americans' pay to come down. And in fact, they made the argument it's possible to run the numbers to show that American manufacturing workers, now keep in mind, people are going to work now at GM for $15 an hour, $14 and change an hour. It's possible to run the numbers to show that American manufacturing workers should take average real wage cuts of as much as 20% to get into global balance. Really? And then they say if American wages get stuck above global market clearing levels as in the 1930s, the result could well be something approaching Depression-era levels of unemployment. You know, what caused Depression-era levels of unemployment was not that people were making too much money. It was that Wall Street robbed us blind. There was this giant, you know, in 1920, Warren Harding ran for president on the Republican ticket on a campaign platform of a deregulating business and privatizing government. And he did. His phrase was, you know, less government in business, more business in government. And he succeeded in doing that. And it dropped the top tax rate from 75% or 91% down to 25%. And, you know, and on it went. I mean, this is what happened. And the consequence of that was this huge stock market bubble, just this explosion in the stock market, this huge stock market bubble that just, you know, from 1921 until 1929 just kept going higher and higher and higher and higher. And You know, I've told you the story before about my old friend Gloria Swanson before she passed on, told me the story of how Joe Kennedy, who was her manager for a time, her lover for a time, and ultimately, according to her, ripped her off pretty badly. Joe Kennedy told her that he, now this is also an apocryphal story, that he got out of the stock market when the shoeshine boy told him, you know, started offering him stock tips. And we've heard that attributed to other people as well. But the reality was that there was this frenzy that was going on. We saw the same thing in the housing market back in the early 2000s. I knew people in the housing market and in the stock market between 2000 and roughly, you know, the big deregulation of 1999 and 2000 of the housing market and the basically the banking industry, right? This giant deregulation led to an explosion of housing speculation and stock market speculation being done based on debt. And I knew people who were quitting their jobs to be day traders. I knew people who were quitting their jobs to buy and sell houses, to flip houses or to become landlords, you know, to buy as many houses as they could as cheaply as they could. And they got nailed in 2008 when the market crashed. I mean, it was speculation that brought this about. It wasn't high wages. So when the New York Times is arguing, or columnists in the New York Times are arguing that wages are too high, and therefore, and this was in 2009 when we were, you know, really suffering, that wages are too high when we were losing, in fact, you know, well, by November that we had pretty much stopped the hemorrhaging, but it was still pretty bad. The wages are too high. It's just a lie.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
What's wrong is our trade policies. Our trade policies are destroying us. And we just saw the greasing of the skids for more of the same yesterday right here in Congress. And welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour, let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and FreeDashDon.org. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, author of Sideswiped, reporter for Talk Radio News Service, is on the line with us. Congressman, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. How are you?
I am great. What's going on in the world? We saw that, you know, the Supreme Court, in fact, we've been talking about it at some length, the Supreme Court said yes to the Affordable Care Act, to Obamacare, and that seems to be the end of that, although Jeb Bush just sent out a fundraiser to all of his supporters saying, please, we need emergency funds right now so that I can become president and overturn Obamacare.
Well, Tom, let me tell you something. If you could have been in Speaker Boehner's office today, you might have gotten hit by a Merlot cork. Noon, okay? It's not the usual noon Merlot cork. It's because the Republicans privately are just as happy as anybody that was supporting that Affordable Care Act. And the proof's already in the pudding. It's an open secret, Tom, on the Hill. There were meetings. In fact, Ted Cruz was at one of the closed-door meetings in the Senate, Republican only, when it was discussed about what do we do just in case, in which there would have been a two-year moratorium in the Senate to continue Obamacare, the health care bill. Then, of course, they would do this and do that and, you know, tweak this. And the House was going to get a little bit more aggressive, but discussions in the House still centered upon the temporary continuing of Obamacare. Now, why would they have to do that at all? Because if they held to what they've said and what they voted on, how many times? 87 times or whatever.
Yeah.
To do away with it.
46,
then all they would have had to have done is just sit there and let it all go away if the Supreme Court had acted differently.
Right.
And so this is a feigning.
Right. Yeah. It's this is a variation, and I'm shocked there's gambling in Casablanca.
Amazing.
Yeah. That's very interesting.
Ellen and I talked about we're going to do a little piece on it, but it's just a fact of life. This now John Boehner, Mitch McConnell, Mitch in the Senate have had their cake and eat it too. Right. I will tell you, you're probably going to see conservative articles, however, going back at them saying, okay, enough's enough. You know, you're really not sincere about this.
Right. And you're going to see Republicans running on, as Jeb Bush just announced, running for president, running for the House, running for the Senate on a platform of, I'll be the guy who repeals Obamacare. Just put me in there.
And they can't. And this is done. This discussion is seriously now over with. No matter if somebody likes this bill or they don't,
right,
it is here and it is here to stay.
Right. And maybe, you know, I mean, when Medicaid was rolled out in the 1960s by Lyndon Johnson, There were 15 or so states that refused to take that money. It was the same deal, only it was a 65% subsidy rather than a 90% subsidy. And all those states eventually fell into line. I think this is going to start happening over the next couple of years, probably right after the presidential elections.
They will. Our state of Ohio, my home state and Alan's home state, fell in line a long time ago with the will of the governor. Tennessee's debating it. But I think the fact that this now has a regular consistency, it's a bill, it's going to be a bill, will mean that more states will come into it, and then it will remain.
Yeah, yeah.
So Tom, I wanted to mention a little bit of green makes the world go around, or the world trade, we should say, go around. There was an article which now a particular group, which was for the trade bill, TPP, this group was formed, and it spent in the month of around month of March about $1.248 million. And specifically, the average Republican who voted yes on the trade bill received about $19,000.
Wow.
The average Democratic member didn't fare as well at $9,600. But there was a lot of money in a short period of time spent.
And that was just in March. I'll bet that it's, you can put a zero at the end of all those numbers for April, May, and June.
Absolutely. And the super PACs. But on top of it, a story yet to be told, we will at some point in time, I've been predicting this, be able to track the money flow from Speaker Boehner from his leadership coffers of money into that directly to money to Republicans who really did not want to vote for that trade bill. And, of course, there's an extreme amount of political retaliation on the Speaker's part by his office, by his staff, on members who would not cooperate. Their mantra is, if you voted against the rule for the trade bill, you were absolutely turning the floor of the House over to Nancy Pelosi.
Right.
Not going against John Boehner. You were turning the floor of the House over to Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader, so she could do as she would please with any form of legislation, as if the whole floor would revert to the hands of Nancy Pelosi.
Right. Yeah.
So I thought it was absolutely just amazing to view that, too. Yep. There was another Supreme Court decision, by the way, today that's really kind of amazing. It was a 5-4. It wasn't like the 6-3 decision, Tom, and that was on housing. It was a Texas case where the awards for housing, you know, the points that they use and the money flow, was only going into housing in to be used to back up housing in particularly poor minority areas only. And that was a discriminatory practice. A lot of civil rights groups, nonprofit groups really didn't like it. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and Justice Kennedy added his name to the, quote, four liberals on the court, which made a 5-4 decision to actually undo discriminatory patterns in funding housing for.
Right, right. And the essence of this was that the policies of the laws don't have to be intentionally discriminatory or even explicitly discriminatory. If their effect is discriminatory, then we consider them discriminatory.
That's right.
Yeah.
So it's a decision that the Kennedy's going to get some grief for, but not that it affects his position whatsoever. But I would note it could have went the other way. He absolutely had added his support to it, and that's what will now undo the Texas discriminatory housing law approach. And then the other thing is the continuing saga of cyber theft. They think up to supposedly 32 million some names have been compromised in the federal system, which leads to what the president's been talking about, cybersecurity and cyber safety. He had a meeting with some Chinese officials in the White House, expressed to them his displeasure at some of the Chinese hacking. Of course, they denied that that's actually at their hands to be done.
Yeah, yeah. Remarkable stuff. Okay.
And then the only other thing is the IRS. Uh-huh. And there's a big question of where more of the emails actually accidentally done away with.
Yeah, okay. More Republican scandal. Bob Ney, thank you so much, Congressman.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Some interesting news. Reason magazine, Nick Gillespie, is writing at the Daily Beast. He says, Reason.com, the website I edit, was recently commanded by the feds to provide information on a few commenters and not discuss it. Here's why we're speaking out. He says, is there anything more likely to make you dump your pants out of a mix of fear and anger than getting a federal subpoena out of the blue? Well, yes, there is. Getting a gag order that prohibits you from speaking publicly about that subpoena or even about the gag order itself. Talk about feeling isolated and cast adrift in the home of the free. You can't even respond when someone asks, are you under a court order not to speak? This all just happened to me and my colleagues at Reason.com, the libertarian website I edit. He says, on May 31st, I blogged about the life sentence given to Ross Ulbricht, the creator of the dark web silk site, by Judge Catherine Forrest. In the comment section, a half dozen commenters unloaded on Forrest, suggesting, among other things, that she should burn in hell or be taken out back and shot. The comments betrayed a naive belief in afterlife and karma, were graphic, spelling challenged, blah-de-blah-de-blah. He says, but a U.S. attorney for the U.S. District Court of the Southern District of New York thought differently and on June 2nd issued a grand jury subpoena to Reason for all identifying information we had on the offending commenters, things such as IP addresses, names, emails, and other information. Then came the gag order on June 4th, barring us from talking about the whole business with anyone outside our organization except our lawyers. He says, first of all, there's no need for it. There wasn't a real threat, but even more outrageous. He says, here the context strongly weighs in favor of hyperbole. The kind of, you know, anyhow, he goes on and on. But can you imagine? I mean, I don't know if the gag order has been lifted and therefore he's now talking about it, or if he's actually, yes, it has been. Okay, so Nick Gillespie was not willing to take on the establishment as it was, and during the time that the gag order was in place, apparently stayed gagged, and now in retrospect is complaining about it. This is, you know, Bernie Sanders fought this. I lived in Vermont when this part of the Patriot Act was first passed, and Bernie was talking about the librarians. The librarians came to Bernie and said, you know, the feds show up and they want to know who's accessing our books on Islam and things like that, and we are not allowed to tell people that we're giving their names to the government. And so what they ended up doing was putting up signs saying the FBI is visiting library, not necessarily the FBI, whoever it was, DHS, is visiting libraries and asking for the records of individual library patrons, and we are not allowed to tell you this. Please pay attention for when this sign vanishes. Right? In other words, and then they would vanish the sign when they get, when they get inspected, as it were. And apparently that happened to Reason Magazine because of some of the comments on their site, which is it's pretty astonishing. It's frankly quite astonishing. Anyhow, anything goes summer here at the third hour of our program. Terry in Pahrump, Nevada. Hey, Terry, what's on your mind?
Two real quick things before I get to the issue. Very sad to hear about Mr. Austin. I will still argue to this day the album cover All Hail Lenin and Marx is the funniest album cover ever made.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the Firesign Theater here we're talking about, firesigntheater.com. Yeah.
Absolutely. The Toad thing I learned about in the Carlos Castaneda books.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. It's part of those. So.
Yeah, you know, I read those books. I wonder if that's where I learned it, too. I mean, I read those books back in the, what, 70s?
Yeah, late 70s for me. I'm a tiny bit younger than you, not a
lot. But I think the books came out in the early 70s. I could be wrong.
Late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
And that's where I learned about it. But what I called about was night before last, you went on a rant at the end of your TV show that I absolutely loved. It was why progressives do not attack conservatives for being traitors if they are racists or misogynists.
Right.
And I want you to know that there are some of us that do. I'm kind of a tiny bit of a confrontational person, so that's actually the very first thing that I go to.
How so?
It's kind of, well, if I hear someone say, you know, them damn or when women vote, if they don't vote the same as their husband, they're canceling out their votes. You know the type of raps I'm talking about. I don't want to be rude on the radio.
That betray either racism or misogyny, right, yes.
The first words out of my mouth are, you're a traitor.
Wow.
And I do that because I know it's going to get ugly, so I figure I may as well get the ugly right out and try and prove my point right away.
Yeah.
And I just wanted you to know, there are some of us that have, and I've been doing it for 20 years. You know, it is something that some of us do. I really appreciated your rant because maybe more people will think along those lines. It does say all men are created equal. Perfect example. To deny two people that love themselves, each other, to marry because of the same sex is, it's disagreeing with our founding fathers who said that all men are created equal.
Right.
It also disagrees with the 14th Amendment and all that other stuff, but I like to go right to the very, very root of it. Because if you disbelieve that initial statement, when you write a political manifesto, you always start with your biggest grievance or your biggest belief first. We went beliefs first, grievances second, and then listed them in the order. The first thing is the foundation. If you do not believe that all men are created equal, it is impossible to believe in any of it that follows because it is all predicated on the fact that all men are created equal.
We're all humans.
So no matter right. The problem is most people that think along those other lines, they conflate capitalism with democracy. They don't understand there's a difference between political and economic. And it just drives me wild because I firmly believe that. If you do not believe that all men are created equal, you cannot, by definition, believe in anything else that follows. And you are, by definition, a traitor.
Or at least not a patriot. Yeah.
I don't even like to be that polite about it.
Okay.
I said I'm kind of a confrontational person.
I guess.
I have found that if you get right to the ugly from the very beginning, it avoids the escalation that allows people to get madder and madder and madder,
right,
and then may result in something unpleasant. So if you get the ugly right out in the open to begin with, you hit people before they have gotten really, really angry with you.
Fascinating.
It sometimes makes them think about it more.
Yeah. Okay, Terry, excellent. Thank you for sharing that. That's brilliant. Susan in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hey, Susan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Your previous caller was a perfect lead-in to what I was going to bring up. He was talking about methods of confronting people who have been brainwashed, affected, or infected by the, you know, the disinformation, brainwashing that comes from sources we're all familiar with. And he is using a frontal attack, which can be useful. But I have developed after many, many years, I have very high creds in the conservative movement. Let's put it that way. So knowing what I know and what I know that they know and what they really think, what I've done, and I don't mean this facetiously, I'm very serious. It's a method based on the fact that you have to change the way people think, the way they think, how they think, not just the information.
We're running out of time, Susan. To the point.
That's the information. So what I say is, I take their thoughts to the logical conclusion, and I take that position, such as, you know, all those people who don't have health care because they can't afford it. Well, isn't that too darn bad? You know, I have to say, let them pay if they can't. Well, this is going to have to die.
Yeah.
And I, considering most people are kind, they look at me like I'm the crazy person.
That's amazing. So that's a brilliant strategy for talking to conservatives. Susan, thank you for calling and sharing it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Just say, oh, you don't like the Affordable Care Act? You think Obamacare is terrible? Well, yeah, I guess we should just let 9 million people die. Yeah. The hell with them. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Scott, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Tallahassee, Florida. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
Great. What's up?
Good. Hey, like you, I've been wondering why Obama would support TPP, and until today I didn't know, but I think I understand it now. My theory is that he had to cut a deal with the Republicans to keep Obamacare, And I don't think it's a coincidence that the Supreme Court comes out with their judgment today, just right coincident with the TPA passing.
I don't think it's that complex, Scott. I think the Supreme Court has a relatively large level of autonomy. I think the Supreme Court upheld Obamacare because Obamacare is a huge boon to the health insurance companies. Their stock all went up this morning. I mean, as soon as that announcement came out, you know, they're getting richer and richer and richer as a result of Obamacare. And so A, and B, I think he's been pushing the TPP because, I mean, his first advisors were Robert Rubin and Larry Summers. President Obama, you know, in terms of economics and trade and domestic policy, by and large, has been a Clinton Democrat or what we used to call an Eisenhower Republican. You know, a Main Street Chamber of Commerce guy. Only now, instead of just the Chamber of Commerce, it's now the International Chamber of Commerce. It's the business roundtables, the CEOs of the 200 largest corporations in the United States, which are functionally, you know, three quarters of them, the largest corporations in the world. That's whose tune he's dancing to. Those are the people who put him into office, in my opinion.
Yeah, that could be.
I think we've got a
disappointing,
you know,
very disappointing. But
yeah, but you know, I mean,
I'm glad we get.
Yeah, he's good on issues, you know, on you know, quote, social issues. He's good on race. He's good on gay issues. He's good on, you know, and he's calling for gun control. I salute that. He does a lot of good stuff. He's you know, working for women and things like this. But when it comes right down to it, the really big players in this country, the banksters, the billionaires, the transnational corporations, you don't get to be president without compromising with those people. And
that is a fact,
you know, at least up until this point. We'll see if Bernie Sanders can pull it off. I'm hopeful and you know, we'll see. And this is where I agree with Ann Coulter. I think, even if it's a Romney Walker ticket, which I think would be probably the strongest Republican ticket out there, that which could beat possibly Hillary Clinton. I don't think they could beat Bernie Sanders because people get it. People are, you know, I mean, Obama has lost much of his base. And because of these kinds of trade deals, and it's just, and you know, the lack of a public option in Obamacare, and you know, it's like things that get done halfway, and that halfway benefits the corporations tremendously. So the health insurance companies over the last 5 years, you know, their stock has just been going up and up and up. The drug companies' stock are going up and up and up. And there are so many things that could be done just by executive order. I mean, he could order Mary Jo White to require all publicly traded corporations to reveal their political contributions. It could be done tomorrow. You know, he could, by executive order, he could basically open up the political process. He could direct the IRS to actually enforce the rules on super PACs and things. But he's not, because you know, it's, you don't bite the hand that feeds you. Scott, thank you for the call. It's 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Steve in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. It was really just following up on that before I get to my topic. It was great to see Bernie on Bill's show last Friday night. And I did miss the overtime segment of Ann Coulter telling Bill Maher that he thought Bernie would win on a ticket.
Did you hear it in the first hour of our show?
Yeah, I saw it. I saw it.
Okay.
There.
I was going to replay it for you if you hadn't. Okay.
No, I didn't. But
yeah,
I want to go ahead sometime.
Yeah.
Obviously. But anyways, knowing this, that Bill was told this, it'd be interesting if Bill will offer Bernie, and if he'll accept the $1 million, because he was a few weeks ago he offered it to Elizabeth, and you know, but she wouldn't accept it, and you know, he did give it to Barack, you know, back in 2012.
Right.
But, but anyways, you know, nobody, with this report that came out about the American workers should take a haircut of 20% or something. Well, they've already been taking a haircut since 2009.
We've been taking a haircut since 1981.
Yeah, totally. Yes. You know, nobody we know has really gotten any raises in the last 6-7 years, And yet, you know, you see inflation. You go to the grocery store, gas prices are down, but they were way up. And home prices are, you know, back a lot of places here, certainly in the valley in certain areas, they're at pre-bust levels, you know.
Yeah.
They're way topped out. Now, the big problem here is who's going to afford these things pretty soon? Because when the interest rates start to rise, I don't think anybody's going to be able to sell their house because nobody's going to have enough income to qualify for it.
Right. When the interest rates start to rise, the economy is going to crash. Mark,
I firmly believe that. I'm terrified what's going on, and I don't know how they're going to get away with preventing it unless they do it so incrementally over a protracted period.
That's what they're trying to do. That's what they're trying to do, and they keep saying, "Well, three months from now we'll think about it. Well, 6 months from now we'll think about it. Yeah, well, 9 months from now we'll think about it." And, you know, the market just, I mean, even just a Fed meeting trembles the market, because what happened was the deregulation of financial markets and the deregulation of the banksters that happened in 1999 and 2000 with the Commodity Futures Modernization Act and Graham Leach Bliley, both promoted by Phil Graham, whose wife Wendy was a director of Enron. These were bills put into place to help out Ken Lay and Enron. These two bills then led to a speculative frenzy, both in the stock market and in the housing market in the United States from 2000 until 2007. And in 2007, the housing market started to collapse. And it would be interesting. I haven't gone back and looked at interest rates to see if, you know, interest rates went up and that was a contributor to it. But in 2007, you know, I remember the second quarter of 2007 seeing that there was a 30% drop in housing starts. And by coincidence, I'd been reading a book about 1929 and how there was a 30% drop in housing starts a year before the stock market crashed. And it moved from Florida, which was the most heavily speculated housing market, all the way up the East Coast over the course of the next year, and then took down the stock market. And I started saying on the air, look out, this is coming. And sure enough, you know, it came. And which is part of the reason why I wrote the book, The Crash of 2016.
Yeah, so, your book is brilliant. I got it as a promotional item a couple of years back. And I tell you, I think you're spot on. I think something's going to happen again. It's bound to.
Yeah.
The writing's on the wall.
Yeah, and we'll see what the consequence of it is. I think it actually might produce a positive outcome. Depends on when it happens and how it's used. I mean, you know, how that crisis is used. Steve, thank you for the call. Andy in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTRR. Hey, Andy, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
Great. What's on your mind?
Good. Hey, you know, I keep hearing everybody talking about the Fox people, you know, so what I do with mine over here, I just go up to them and I say, oh, so you're libertarian? Oh, no, I'm Republican. I go, well, you seem to be voting for libertarians awful lot. And he looks at me and goes, well, I'm not a libertarian. I go, well, I kind of think you are.
Yeah. And what's a libertarian? It's somebody who doesn't understand basic economics or politics.
Exactly. You know, and most of these people over here, you know, they're voting for all these Republicans, and pretty much most of the guys that, you know, that are in office, they seem to be voting a lot the libertarian values, you know.
Right. Libertarian values being basically turn everything over to the corporations and the billionaires. Don't worry,
exactly.
They know how to run things. I mean, that's
exactly.
If you wanted to encapsulate libertarian theology in a sentence or two. Well, I call them Republicans who want to get laid and smoke dope, you know, decriminalize pot and prostitution. But by the way, screw the working people, you know, to hell with the poor. And I got mine. And, you know, that's basically libertarianism. Fascinating, Andy. And thanks for listening to WTRR there in Grand Rapids. Chris in Darlington, South Carolina, listening on Sirius. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Yes, sir. Read an interesting thing on Facebook. I don't know how true it is this morning, but apparently there's, I don't know the exact mechanism of how it works in D.C., but apparently the city council votes the law, the mayor signs it, and then some committee in the House of Representatives gets to give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down.
Yeah, that's the not just the House. I believe it's the House and the Senate. It might be the House. But basically, anything that happens here in the district has to be approved or can be shot down by Congress. Andy Miller, I think his name is, the congressman from Maryland. Andy Harris, I think. Blew up our pot decriminalization, for example.
Yeah, you know, what this thing said was that, you know, I guess a law was the city law or ordinance was passed in response to the Hobby Lobby thing that employer health plans in D.C. would include birth control.
Right.
And they used a mechanism in the House, apparently, that not only did they disapprove that law, but they did it in such a way that now employers in D.C. will have the right to fire any woman they discover is actually using any kind of birth control, whether employee paid or not.
Right. And this is the interpretation of that Supreme Court decision in Hobby Lobby, and there are employers who are asserting that and saying, you know, hey, my religion says you women, you can't take. Yeah, it's a grim story, Chris. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to us on Sirius Progress. Whew, a lot going on. By the way, some speculation that one of Jeb Bush's biggest vulnerabilities might be the voter purge that he and Catherine Harris did in 2000 to get his brother elected in Florida. You think that's going to come back to haunt him? I hope so. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Scott Conroy is blogging about this over at the Huffington Post. Florida voter purge fiasco may complicate Jeb Bush's appeal to minorities. You think? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Guardian, here's how much corporations paid U.S. senators to fast-track the TPP bill. Now, this was back in the end of May, May 27th. So this was, 2 weeks ago, roughly, more or less? Fast-tracking the TPA, meaning it's, this is by C. Robert Gibson and Taylor Channing. And they talk about, using data from the Federal Election Commission, this chart shows all donations that corporate members of the U.S. Business Coalition for TPP, which is just a single pro-TPP group, made to U.S. Senate campaigns between January and March, when the fast track was being debated. Out of the total of $1.148971 million, $1,148,971 given, an average of $17,600 was donated to each of the 65 yes votes. The average Republican member received $19,000 from corporate TPP supporters. The average Democrat received $9,600 from those same donors. The amounts given rise dramatically when looking at how much each senator running for re-election received. 2 days before the fast-track vote, Obama was a few votes shy of having the filibuster-proof majority he needed. Ron Wyden and seven other Senate Democrats announced they were on the fence on the 12th of May. In just 24 hours, Wyden and five of those Democratic holdouts, Michael Bennett of Colorado, Dianne Feinstein of California, Claire McCaskill of Missouri, Patty Murray of Washington, and Bill Nelson of Florida, caved and voted for fast-track. Bennett, Murray, and Wyden, all running for re-election in 2016, received $105,900 between the three of them. Bennett, who comes from the more purple state of Colorado, got $53,700 in corporate campaign donations between January and March, according to Channing's research. Almost 100% of the Republicans in the U.S. Senate voted for fast track. And then they go through the list of who got what from whom. Rob Portman, for example, who former U.S. Trade Representative, he's now the senator from Ohio. He received $119,000 from 14 different corporations, most of which came from Goldman Sachs, $70,000, Pfizer, $15,000, Procter & Gamble, $12,000. Portman is expected to run against Ted Strickland in 2016 to be the governor of Ohio. Oh, I'm sorry, for re-election. This must be for the Senate. Seven Republicans who voted yes to Fast Track are also running for re-election. Senator Johnny Isaacson of Georgia received $102,000 in corporate campaign contributions. Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri, best known for proposing a Monsanto written bill in 2013 that became known as the Monsanto Protection Act, he got $77,900, $13,500 of which came from Monsanto. What a surprise. What's surprising is how cheap these guys are selling out our country. 81-year-old Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, who's running for his seventh Senate term, received $35,000. Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, who will be running for his first full six-year term, received $67,500. Mansour Gidfar, spokesman for the anti-corruption group Represent.us, said it's a rare thing for members of Congress to go against the money these days. If you can buy a congressional vote that is going to turn $100 billion worth of trade into profit, with a $1.1 million contribution to a couple of senators, we have really gone over the edge. I mean, we have just gone so far over the edge, so far. I don't know how to say it. This is absolute evidence that we live in a plutocracy, an oligarchy, rather than a democratic republic. And you can thank the Supreme Court for it, by the way. They legalized this in 1976 in a case called Buckley. They amplified that a year later in 1977 in a case called First National Bank versus Pilotti. And then they brought it all together and put it on steroids in 2010 with Citizens United and last year with McCutcheon. Ed in Reedsport, Oregon. Hey, Ed, what's up? Ed, can you hear me in Reedsport, Oregon? Okay, let's try Candon in Baldwin, Missouri. Candon,
how are you doing?
Hey, good. What's up?
Hey, when I turned on the radio, you were talking about the Reason.com situation with the FBI investigating him. I listen to your show a lot. I agree with most everything you say, and I got to disagree pretty heavily with this one. You had an individual, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I didn't see the article, but you had some individuals that basically threatened someone's life on a message board, and the FBI investigates this the way that I think they should.
Right.
And when they're investigating something, putting a gag order on them so that way a temporary gag order, which was lifted, yeah, not a permanent one, but a temporary gag order so they could go ahead and investigate this, try and find the individuals, you know, that were threatening someone's life and do their job, you're saying is inappropriate. And my biggest issue with that is you compared it to the librarians, which I don't see the connection to. If you're going to have someone just sit here and say, hey, you rented this book or you bought this or bought that, and you do a search that way, I don't see how that connects with somebody putting out a death threat to somebody else. I pretty strongly disagree with that.
Candon, you make a reasonable point. You make a reasonable point, an absolutely reasonable point. And yeah, if somebody's making death threats, you know, I would support the FBI tracking them down. And if it was happening on my message board, I would be disinclined to talk about it. I would want them to find out that person making those death threats. The argument that and probably I did a disservice to the Reason guys, because the argument that he makes in the piece, and you might want to look it up, is that these were regular message board members who were engaging in hyperbolic talk that was not legitimate death threats, and that they routinely talk these kinds of ways. It was, you know, that it wasn't a legitimate threat. But on the other hand, you know, the FBI has to take any kind of threat as a potentially serious threat. And, you know, it could have been Joker Tsarnaev, you know, you just don't know. So, and the threat was against a judge. So this is a little more serious. So, Candon, thank you. I stand corrected. I agree with you. Will in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hey, Will, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. I have a comment and a question.
Yeah.
And my comment is, with everything you've been talking about today and every other day, really, isn't a way to frame what's happened to the United States is we have become a colony of these transnational corporations.
Sure, just like we were a colony of the East India Company in 1773 when the colonists decided to rise up and commit $1 million act of vandalism against three ships carrying tea in the Boston Harbor.
And they have bought our political class, and they serve their interests, not ours now?
That's correct. That's absolutely correct.
And my question for you is, I haven't read your book, I don't have it yet, the 2016.
Yeah.
But would it not serve those interests and the Republicans that the great crash occur during the election, and then they can blame it on Obama and Obama's policies and peg Hillary or whoever Democrats running
that's,
for the office?
That's one of the things that I speculate about in the book and that I will do right now on the air. This is coming. I mean, there's a very broad consensus kind of across the board among many economists. I've had this conversation with Richard Wolff and others, you know, serious economists that we never did undo the damage that Phil Gramm and his Republican buddies did and that Bill Clinton signed off on in 99 and 2000 with Graham Leach Bliley and which blew up Glass-Steagall and with the Commodity Futures Modernization Act that allowed for these derivatives. We're back to $500 trillion in derivatives right now. And only now they're being based on car loans rather than house loans. and student loans. But because we haven't dealt with the fundamentals, this crash is going to happen. So then the question becomes the politics of it. I'm of the opinion that this administration and the Fed are trying desperately to hold this thing off until after the elections. And so that would mean that it would happen in December of 2016 in order to get a Democrat elected. I don't think the Fed is that politicized. I think they're just trying to hold it off, period. But, you know, they're trying to do really what Congress should be doing. They're reinflating the bubble. Congress should be fixing the system so we don't need to depend on bubbles to have an economy that works. That said, and George Bush was trying to do the same thing, by the way. They knew in 2007 that the economy was going to crash. You could see it when the housing started to collapse in the second quarter of 2007. They knew it was coming, and Bush thought he could hold it off until after November, and he was off by 6 months. And that's one of the reasons why Barack Obama got elected president. So if the crash happens before the election, it's entirely possible that a Republican would come into office, and this is why I think the Republicans in Wall Street might provoke a crash before the election, so that basically Obama will be blamed for it the same way Bush was blamed for it, you know, 8 years ago or 6 years ago, 7 years ago. On the other hand, if the crash happens before the primary, then I think that it's entirely possible that Bernie Sanders would win the Democratic primary because Hillary Clinton would be seen as too close to Wall Street, and Wall Street will be the clear villain in this thing. And if Bernie Sanders, and this is where I agree with Ann Coulter, if Bernie Sanders is the Democratic nominee, there is no Republican who can beat him because he's the only genuine populist out there. And the Republican Party is going to have to reboot themselves. We'll see. As Mike Dirks, the great Zen master from Portland, says, we'll see. And then on the third hand, if the crash happens right after the election, then whoever is in the White House, if it's a Democrat in the White House, I think that they're going to get a lot of political support for doing something. You go back and I write about this in my book, The Crash of 2016, exactly what the political climate was like in 1932 when Franklin Roosevelt was running for president. So it's a very interesting thing, and we'll see how it plays out, Will. I this is all speculation on my part, what the political consequences would be. I don't think I'm speculating when I say the crash is coming. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your calls right after the break. And welcome back. Keith, watching Free Speech TV in Pauā, Hawaii. Hey, Keith. Aloha. Keith? Oh, no, not again. Okay, let's try Ed in Reedsport, Oregon. Ed, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Oh, excellent. Love your show, by the way. Totally. Question, simple. TPP, how do we get out of it a year from now, 5 years, when we have buyer's remorse, too many of our rights are being usurped, and too many laws are being rewritten on behalf of the industrialists and so forth? How do we get out of it? I think if people knew, I think it might be a significant thing for the public to know by way of stopping the TPP, when it's brought up again.
Right. Any law that's passed can be unpassed. It just takes the will of the legislature and the signature of the president. So these trade agreements going all the way back to most favored nation status in China, I think all of them should be repealed, and we should go back to a protectionist trade policy. And I realize that I say that, and even Paul Krugman's head explodes. He and I had a debate about this on a cruise ship back about 5 years ago, 6 years ago. But that's the only way I see for it to work.
But aren't there penalties? I mean, Greece can't get out of the European Union because of all kinds of snarling stuff.
Yeah.
There must be stuff, because otherwise the first time somebody says, you can't, we want your water, and the government says no, Then we just leave.
There are substantial penalties, just like there will be substantial penalties to Greece if they leave the European Union and go back to the drachma. And over the short term, year, 2 years, maybe 3 years, those penalties will bite. And as if we were to start erecting tariffs, what you would see is all of a sudden the cost of your iPhone is going to go from $500 to $600. The cost of your TV is going to go, your new TV is going to go from, you know, $250 to $350. The prices will start to rise. And as those prices start to rise, then it will become viable to manufacture things at those price points here in the United States. And American manufacturing will begin to revive itself. And as American manufacturing begins to revive itself, people will be put back to work. The labor market will tighten up. Wages will go up. As wages go up, disposable income will go up. And we'll be back in that virtuous cycle that we were in from 1793 to 1981, rather than the death spiral that we've been in from 1981 to today. Because economies are basically always moving in one of two directions. They're either moving up or they're moving down. And the main thing that drives that up or down is the amount of money that is in the hands of consumers. You know, 70% of our economy roughly is consumer spending. And when consumers are spending money that is non-debt money, in other words, they're not putting it on their credit card, they're taking it out of their paycheck, that stimulates the economy. It stimulates demand. So I think that Greece, frankly, and I know that my thinking is shared by many people in the Syriza party. I've spoken with some of them. I think the best thing Greece could do right now is exit the European Union. There's a whole political party, Podemos, in Spain that is rising really rapidly to do the same thing, get Spain out of the EU and go back to the Spanish peso. And, you know, yeah, there'll be a year or two of just total economic chaos. You know, how do you convert this to that? Who moved their money offshore? You got to work with these things. But once you've done that, you've got your sovereignty back. And once you've got your sovereignty back, you can run your country in a way that works to its own benefit. So, yeah, it's going to be a painful thing. But frankly, it's going to avoid a much larger pain over the long period, which we've been experiencing since 81. Ed, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Ryan in Belmar, New Jersey. Hey, Ryan, what's on your mind?
Hey, I just had a question. My understanding is that the founding fathers hated political parties, so I'm trying to understand why they started them in the first place, and whether wouldn't it be an ideal to strive for to get rid of them today? Just have everyone run as an independent. You don't have the sheep thinking going on. Would that be an objective that you think would be a good idea?
No, and I don't think it would be possible either. It defies human nature. Human nature is for people to gather together in community and do things for, you know, for their common good. The founders of this country, of our republic, did not hate political parties. If you read Federalist Number 10, James Madison talks about the danger of factions. And people think that faction means political party. Ryan, if you're seriously curious about this subject, Dan Sisson and I wrote a book called The American Revolution of 1800, which is about the election of Thomas Jefferson and the repudiation of John Adams. John Adams was moving us in a direction that is very much like today's Republican Party, and Thomas Jefferson just blew that up with the election of 1800. And there's a whole chapter in there quoting a whole bunch of the founding fathers about faction. Faction was defined in 1776 or in, all the way through the 18th century. Faction was defined as a group of people who are behaving in a way that meets two criteria. The first is they're advocating policies that largely or exclusively benefit them, and the second is these policies work to the detriment of the country. So when Madison was arguing against faction in Federalist Number 10, he was arguing against speculators. He was arguing against, you know, there were a bunch of groups that were like trying to get laws passed and trying to get things done that would only benefit them and that would work to the disadvantage of the nation. And that's what he was dissing. Madison was one of the co-founders, along with Jefferson, of the Democratic, what is today the Democratic Party. Back then it was called the Democratic Republican Party. First it was called the Anti-Federalist Party. And George Washington was one of the founders of the Federalist Party, along with Alexander Hamilton. So they didn't dislike political parties. What they disliked was faction. And I would submit to you that we are now at that cancer stage of capitalism, cancer stage of small d democracy point that Madison warned about in Federalist Number 10, or maybe it was Number 12. I think it was Number 10, though, that in as much as you have factions now, like, you know, Koch Industries or ExxonMobil, who are funding politicians, you know, so Jim Inhofe can throw a snowball on the floor of the Senate. They're funding factions, right? They're funding groups that are working to stop any discussion of climate change, for example. These are factions. They're not political parties. And the factions have seized control of the political parties. So there's a very clear distinction between faction and party. There weren't political parties at the time the Constitution was written, so there's no reference to them in the Constitution. But you know, they were acknowledged later on when we figured out that the, you know, whoever gets the most and the second most votes doesn't make the best president and vice president. That all got changed in the 1820s, as I recall. So, have I answered your question, Ryan?
Yes, but I'm also wondering, what, when they were talking about factions, were they just talking about companies, or like, could you name any of them that were specifically referenced?
You know, the folks in the North, John Adams defined one of the factions as people with what were called personality interests, which literally was slave owners. So that was one of the factions. The bankers in New York, Jefferson identified the bankers as a faction. There were the importers and exporters who were arguing for and against tariff laws and having huge fights with Alexander Hamilton and the George Washington administration. Those were factions. So basically it was, you know, it wasn't, the modern day corporation hadn't yet been invented, but the precursors were certainly there. It was mostly wealthy people or industries that were fighting for these things. And as I said, all the detail of this, and Dan Sisson and I actually, we went chapter through chapter through chapter through the book, and you can find it on our website at youtube.com/Tom Hartman. My conversations with Dan, where if you don't want to buy the book or read the book, you can just listen to us talking about it. And he lays it out in great detail. He's a professor up in the Pacific Northwest, and he wrote the first draft of that book in, you know, 40 years ago. And then I edited it, and we brought it and wrote a new foreword and a new afterword for it, and we brought it out again. So it's the book is the American Revolution of 1800 by Dan Sisson and Tom Hartman. Ryan, thank you for the call. Jim in Pocahontas, Arkansas. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Tom, I don't want to deprioritize issues. There's a lot of issues that are confronting our nation here, but one that we haven't heard much on is having to do with the young man in South Carolina who committed this egregious act.
Yes, this terrorist.
And we try to figure out what makes a human being become this kind of person. And it came to us as we were discussing this that this young man was, at some point in his life, had to be brainwashed, if you will, for the lack of a better term.
Yeah.
He drives a relatively late model vehicle. He committed this act with a very expensive 9mm Glock and very expensive ammunition. You know, the question is, who gave that to him?
Right.
Who
I would like to know that too, Jim. Actually, apparently his father gave him the gun. And the thing that troubles me is his middle name, which is Storm. And, you know, Strom, this is a big and important word for the Aryan Nation people, for the people who, you know, like this kid, he drew 88 in the sand. That's the eighth letter of the alphabet is H. So when you see 88 on one of these right wing message boards, it means Heil Hitler. And I'm wondering, you know, if his parents were white supremacists. In fact, I'd be willing to bet on it, although they have not said a word. They have not been willing to do any interviews, which makes me even more suspicious. Jim, thanks for the call. Thank you all for being with us this hour. My apologies to the folks who are still on the board. We didn't get to your calls. Call back tomorrow. We will continue. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require all of us to participate. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
Been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.